Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome to episode 88 of the Potential Psychology Podcast. I hope you're well and enjoying whatever it is you're doing right now. I hope that you're engaging in some kind of immersive experience while you're listening in, maybe running or walking or cycling. You might, of course, be driving or cooking, or perhaps you're cleaning the house. Whatever you're doing, are you paying attention to what's happening in your body and mind while you're doing it? Are you noticing how you're moving or breathing or feeling physically or emotionally? Are you paying attention to what you're thinking or how you're thinking? Are you perhaps wondering what on earth I'm talking about, or trying to figure out how you are supposed to listen to me, think about what's going on in your body and mind, and do whatever it is you're doing right now? Whatever it is, stay safe. If you're driving or cycling, make sure you're paying attention to what you're doing, but stay with me because this is going somewhere, I promise. Last weekend was a long weekend here, and we took advantage of the lifting of some COVID restrictions to head to the coast for a mini family holiday, which was absolutely glorious. And while I was there, because I was steadfastly avoiding doing any work, I found a jigsaw that was left in our accommodation for guests. And so I embarked on the very ambitious goal of completing a 750-piece jigsaw in just over 48 hours. And while I was busy with my jigsaw at the dining table in our little beachside holiday house, in those kind of quiet mid-afternoon lulls while everyone was occupied and also late at night, I started to pay attention to what was happening in my mind as I completed the jigsaw, or didn't quite complete it, as it turns out. 48 hours was a bit too ambitious, but what I did do is pay attention to, what was going on in my brain. And this is what psychologists call metacognition. So thinking about your thinking while you're doing it. And I was intrigued by how when you start a jigsaw, you tend to work on the really obvious, easiest parts first, like finding all of the edge pieces and corners and assembling those. And then there might be a really clear feature of the jigsaw, like a colour or a shape or a person or an animal that's easy to identify. And then you assemble those pieces. And you tend to start there, not everyone, of course, because every jigsawer, if that's a word, has their own strategy. But for me, at least, I start there because everything else feels too difficult or overwhelming at that point. An expanse of sky or water or large sections in which all the pieces seem to look alike are just too difficult. And so for me, at least, that gets left until last in favour of the easier parts. But what I noticed was that as you spend more and more time immersed in the world of your jigsaw, your mind starts to be able to identify subtle differences in the parts that all look the same before. So you start to see variations in all of the shades of green in a landscape, for example, or you might notice the individual shapes of the pieces and how they differ and where those pieces of that shape might belong. And you use these as clues as to where to put them. And your attention and your understanding of what you're doing and your ability to see things that you just couldn't see before, little differences and little details, improves. It's like you just see things that you couldn't see before. And these are all elements of attention and what we call visual perception and awareness, and our brain's ability to detect and discriminate and categorize particular stimuli, in this place, the colors and shapes and patterns and pictures on bits of jigsaw, in different ways. And when you start to pay attention to all of these processes that are taking place in your brain, usually without your awareness at all, it's really quite awe-inspiring. Your brain is doing all of this cool, complex processing of information and leading you to awareness that you didn't previously have. And then it helps you to notice things and solve problems and then experience the thrill of placing that elusive jigsaw piece in just the right spot. And that's all happening in your brain at a neurological level while you thought you were just mindlessly filling in time doing a jigsaw. And that links really well with what we're talking about in today's interview. I told you there was a point to all of that. But instead of just your visual perception, we're talking in this conversation about a whole range of really cool stuff that your brain is doing while you are physically present in the world, particularly as you move through it. So there are layers and layers of processing and activity taking place in your brain while you walk or jog or cycle or hike or just move from one space to another. Processes that we don't notice, but they play a huge part in keeping us safe, keeping us upright, keeping us able to move, and ultimately keeping us fit and healthy as we grow and learn and age. So let's explore this, all of this interesting layer and layer of brain processing in such fascinating ways with our guest, shall we? With me today, speaking from California, is Dr. Scott Grafton, neuroscientist and neurologist, distinguished professor of psychological and brain science at the University of California, Santa Barbara, researcher into how people organize movement into goal-oriented action, and author of Physical Intelligence, The Science of Thinking Without Thinking. Plus, I have to say, from reviewing your biography, many, many other achievements, positions of note and interests that are way too numerous to mention here. But we are going to talk today about this notion of physical intelligence. Welcome, Scott.
Well, thanks for having me.
Look, as I was just saying off air, and I know I end up doing this in my intro in just about every episode because it's always a quick conversation about the topical things first, is that I did listen, not read, but listen to Physical Intelligence, The Science of Thinking Without Thinking, while walking my dog because, well, partly for efficiency reasons, because when you've got a lot of books to read and get through, finding ways to multitask while you're doing so is always a good strategy. But also because it did occur to me that if we're talking about something like physical intelligence, then an element of physicality beyond the very limited physicality normally involved in reading books should probably take place. So, what is physical intelligence? I'm going to start with a really obvious question.
It's everything that's us that really is not what we talk about. So our minds are really a machine for conversing with others in many ways, right? We live in a world of verbal ideas and talking and social interaction, and not to belittle any of that at all, but that's like icing on the cake. I mean, what we really are is a physical organism that has to stay alive and procreate and, you know, move around. And so at our core is the ability to do things and to move. And without that, all the talking in the world isn't going to help you. And we kind of think about this sort of as, you know, we all talk about sort of mind-body relationships, but more as a metaphor than really as a concrete idea. So the idea of this book and physical intelligence is to say there's a lot of machinery that is mind-body and kind of the connection of mind-body, and kind of going through my favorite stories of patients and physiology and anatomy that really make this idea concrete, that we are a physical entity and we have a lot of brain power devoted just to that.
And it is something that we absolutely forget. And to be honest, I have to say, you know, as soon as that concept was introduced in the book, it really got me thinking about the amount of time, and I guess in part because of my profession as a psychologist, but also just generally, maybe more so, maybe increasingly, maybe as we, you know, spend a lot of time sitting in offices and spend a lot of time in kind of service economies and all of the work that we do and the way that we live, that we do spend an awful lot of time talking about what we think or we feel, and very little time devoted to what we're physically doing or not doing potentially in all of that.
Yeah, I agree. And when we do talk about physicality, we always talk about, well, not always, but we often frame it in the context of exercise. I need to go exercise. And that's not what this is not an exercise book, right? Physical intelligence, we often talk about brilliant athletes and their physical intelligence, but we all have that brilliance to a certain degree. They're just a little more tuned at one thing or another. And so that's what it's about, is the sheer physicality of being alive, right? I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time in the book emphasizing, you know, we live in a really cushy world now, but we didn't evolve in a cushy world. We evolved in a really rough and tumble world. There were no trails. There was no nothing, right? It was jungles and rocks and mountains and glaciers and whatever. And that's what our bodies were really designed to move through. And we rarely get a chance now to experience that intensity of physicality that we're perfectly designed for. You know, there's a part in the book where I talk about anybody who's not injured, who's reasonably healthy, can walk out their door and easily walk 50 miles, right? I mean, that's what we're designed to do. And you think, well, I couldn't do that. There's no water bottles along the way, but it's, you know, we can all do that, right? It's amazing.
It's raining.
Right? It's raining. I don't have an umbrella. So in part, it's just to celebrate that evolutionary history. And if you look at it, physical intelligence through that lens, you really see how well designed we are to do certain things like walking, and walking on rough and tumble surfaces, not just sidewalks. Our bodies cherish sort of complexity in the natural environment. And we all know that. You go to any nature park, right? We're all happy there, right? We all love it. Well, explain that, right?
Yeah. And that was one of the interesting things for me, because I know, you know, we increasingly are understanding the positive impact that nature and your involvement in nature, that kind of biophilic hypothesis stuff that says that, you know, if we're in nature. But again, I think we still think of that in an intellectual sense. It's something about just being present in nature, and somehow that just, you know, we absorb it through our pores and that makes us feel good. And there probably is an element of that as well. But your argument is that it's the physical movement in that space that plays a big part in what happens in our brain and then contributes to our growth in all sorts of different ways.
That's exactly right. It's the physicality of those environments and moving through them and really experiencing them with all your senses, you know. Mm. That's really what I think drives our emotional benefit from it. Now, that's something I kind of end the book with. And if I were to write a second book, that's kind of, I think that would be the deep dive, right? That's a hard thing to write about scientifically, because there's a lot less direct evidence. I can talk a lot about how you keep track of where your body is in space, or how you coordinate movement, or how you get dexterous, or how you're efficient at movement. But to talk about how it is our ability to fit into a natural environment benefits us outside of the realm of, well, you're exercising, right? There's a lot less evidence, but it is growing, and there's a lot of really fun and fascinating indirect evidence. In Europe, there are all these interesting studies. Now, if you're in a nursing home, and you know, an elder care home, and you're still ambulatory, and that's next to a nature park, you're going to do better. You're going to survive better compared to one that's just got concrete sidewalks, right? Just simple things like that. You know, I spent a lot of time in the book talking about, as you age, just how hard it is actually to stay upright. And, you know, we think that, oh, we learn to move. Like, I learned to walk. I'm done with that part of learning. I already know how to walk. And that's true to a certain extent, but also you're always forgetting a little bit. All movements are constantly faced with sort of rust, you know, like you just get rusty at what you're doing. And you quickly adapt and relearn. But as you age, that relearning slows down, and it sets us up for literally forgetting how to walk or how to climb ladders. I mean, you know what to do cognitively, but your body is sloppy at it. And so people falling down and going to emergency rooms, I mean, that's the most common reason people go to the emergency room if they're injured, is they just fell down. So practice, this is part of it. I think the reward you get from moving, I think your body's, well, let's just say your brain is designed to get reward just by the sheer act of moving. And it does that so that you don't get rusty at moving, right? You have to, it's a self-fulfilling process to keep you dexterous and efficient and sort of graceful in your actions. Imagine if every time you walked down the hallway, you thought, oh, what a chore. I got to remember how to do this. And it's so effortful, right? Instead, you know, our brains don't they're not designed to make us feel that way.
And because it is, it's taking something that is extraordinarily complex and quite amazing when you sit back and consider it, the way we do move, how we operate in space, we absolutely take that for granted, which probably plays into a little piece of what you were saying there, that because we take it for granted, we don't think that we need to put any conscious effort into maintaining it as a skill or a capability that we have. But that very notion of how we move through space, you know, can you talk a little bit, because you do cover this in the book, you know, how do we conceptualize that sense of space and how we fit in it? What's actually going on in our brain at that point?
Well, we do it a lot of ways. We have proximity sensors, just like the new cars have with the little radar on the bumpers, so they beep at you when you get close to somebody. We have neurons in our brain. If something just comes close to your face, it doesn't even touch it, those things are going off like those little alarms in your car. So we're very, very sensitive to what's close to face and close to hands that we can see. So we have all that kind of sense of space. But to me, the most interesting sense of space is one that's framed in terms of action. So you can think about space as just sort of empty stuff out there. But you can also think about it as opportunities for action, right? I can't walk through walls. The wall defines what I can and can't do. A tree defines what I can and can't do. I can't walk through the tree. And we do all that without even naming it as a tree or naming it as a wall. We don't need to do that. We just see the surfaces. And Gibson just thought of these as sort of a direct kind of perception. It's something you'll see in the most primitive organisms with a visual system. They will start to represent space in terms of what's possible and not possible. And that's how deep sort of you have to think about what we're really doing under the hood most of the time. We're tracking the texture of the surface we're walking on, right? Just the unevenness of the terrain. And then it gets even more crazy, right? Because then you can think, well, all right, those are the things that constrain space, but what is space itself? And that's another thing we take for granted. We think that space is, and then our brain puts stuff in it. But our brain has to make the space as well, right? It has to create the notion of emptiness that you're going to put things in. It doesn't, you know, your brain is, it's not like there's a galaxy in there full of stars. It is just a bunch of neurons that are cooking up stories about, you know, what might be out there. And so at a very minimum, it has to say, okay, there's an operational space. I am an organism and there's this area around me. And what's so cool about that in people is that's conceptually, we can think about the space of the room we're in, and I can immediately think about Melbourne, right? or Australia, right? I can go all the way. I can immediately think about all the space that it, so I can shrink and expand this idea of space really easily. And I spent a lot of time in the book talking about patients with neglect syndrome, which is a kind of, you know, they have usually a stroke in the brain, and they end up getting a void in their ability to construct space. So it's like I call it like a black hole. It's called neglect, but that's not a fair term because they're not really neglecting anything. They're not constructing.
It's just not there.
They lose that ability. It's not there. Mm. There's nothing there to work with. And so I oftentimes think about this in terms of like the emergency rescue team, the emergency management team or search and rescue. They have to search and find you. The first thing they do is they make a map and they say, okay, what's the area we're going to search in? So this is a case where you don't even have a map. You can't even start there. You can't even say, where are we even going to search? Well, I don't know. Could be anywhere, right? Because there's no, they can't even construct the idea of a map. So that's so, these are all the sort of the real nuts and bolts of the things that you need to be physical, right? And to really move in the world.
Yeah, and I think that example of the neglect, you know, a deficit, you know, somebody who's actually lost a capability that we take for granted, that does illustrate for me listening to that, that idea that this is something quite magical in some ways, you know, about what the brain could do. You know, imagine me not being able to imagine myself being in my town, in my city, in my country, in the world, mm-hmm. you know, imagine just some of that being a black space and how disorienting and confusing that would be if I was literally only able to conceptualize what I saw in front of me and wove my way around. You don't then have that ability to plan. You know, if I want to get from here to where I'm going to buy my lunch, if that was a deficit, if I couldn't conceptualize where that was, you know, how would I even go about doing that?
Yeah. There's a very famous jazz pianist, Keith Jarrett. I think he's 75 now. He's probably one of the greatest jazz pianists of all time. And he had a stroke a couple of years ago, and he's lost function of his left hand. And I just read an interview with him. And what's interesting is he talks about, he doesn't even know what to do with that side of the piano anymore. So it is kind of a neglect there, right? So it's like, you know, the left side of the piano, the whole bass side of the piano, you know, people say, well, just play some stuff with your right hand. But for him, he has to have the piano. It has to be the whole piano. And part of the piano is just now fundamental. It's not just because his hand can't move. It's the whole left side isn't there.
So his brain's just not perceiving that whole.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's what's going on in him just from the scant interview. But that would make it very hard, right, to be able to play again. And he talks about that.
And extremely distressing, I can imagine.
Yeah, very frustrating.
Yeah. Scott, one of the lovely elements of your book that I really enjoyed was that you pull a narrative throughout the book of your own, because you are a keen hiker and climber, as I understand it. And so you have this wonderful narrative of your own experience piece by piece that then kind of is reflected, and you go deeper into the science of it, of moving through a physical space as you actually are heading off on what turns out, and I never heard the actual outcome, what appeared to be looking like it was a somewhat calamitous experience. Okay. And one of the pieces that you talk about, and you mentioned before, this sort of notion of robots or cyborgs, and you're talking about that being able to move through a rough terrain. So we think about this thinking without thinking and our body being able to do these magical things that we just take for granted. And it was this, you know, we don't have to think about necessarily, you know, if you're crossing a creek and I've got a little bit of balancing and a few rocks that I have to step on, or I'm hiking and I'm covering rough terrain, we just do it. And yet when we try to replicate this using machines, it really illustrates how complex it is, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really hard still to train them to do it the way, to figure out the algorithms you would need to do it the way we do it. It's getting there, right? So whatever I say, you know, is going to be wrong because the engineering field is moving so fast. But at the time I wrote the book, you know, the best you could do is essentially make robots to get them to walk on really rough terrain. Basically, they were mostly quadrupeds, and you make them have legs like a goat, and then you just have them sort of stomp up and down with really high steppage with quick reflexes. And they just sort of catch themselves if they're falling, but they're not anticipating where they put their feet. That's the big thing. They're putting the foot down, and if it starts to get tippy, you put the other one down sooner.
It's sort of that automatic feedback.
It's automatic reactive control. And the same is true with the Boston Dynamics bipedal robots. They're really humanoid robots. There's tons of them on the internet. They're fun to watch. But they're just sort of quickly reacting to loss of balance. And so the challenge now is to get them to see the world, to see the surfaces, just like this idea Gibson had of what's possible, what's not possible, and what are the textures like, and how would you adjust where you put your feet and where you put your weight based on all those surfaces and features of the world. They don't see the world that way yet. And the reason that's hard is I think you truly have to marry vision and action. When that happens, well, actually, I think that'll be a sort of a revolution in how we think about how brains actually really work. In neuroscience right now, you have people who are experts in vision, and you have people who are experts in movement. And to just walk on an uneven surface, those have to be perfectly married. You have to be able to anticipate the future and predict what your body's going to do. And to do that, you have to really see it. And so these fields really have to come together. And so it'll happen.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, so many exciting things, you know, as particularly around that part of the discussion in the book, but, you know, so many things I kind of, oh, that's going to be so cool when we learn this, when we explore this, when we understand this. One of the things that, you know, from my understanding is that there's an element of learning that's involved in part of this. You know, we actually have to do some of this stuff to then be able to. So you do argue that, you know, you have friends, for example, who are incredibly fit, spend a lot of time in the gym, you know, they might be the muscular, they can lift heavy things, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But that is a different form of physicality than this actual experiential exploring the world, exploring those textures, walking on those rough things, so that that does feed into the system and we can understand what we can and can't do.
Yeah. And that argument could be made a lot stronger. It was sort of more of a proposal in the book. And I think that's something to follow up with as more evidence emerges. But it's the difference between physical engagement in complex environments versus exercise. Just imagine jogging on a treadmill versus jogging down a mountain trail. They're profoundly different experiences. One has optic flow, the other doesn't. And optic flow is this magic thing, right? Where you're just, the environment's flowing around you as you go. It is really powerful, both emotionally and also just in terms of enhancing your coordination and your abilities. It's not to say that exercise is bad for you. It's better than nothing.
Of course.
But the argument is you could do better, right? You can be very creative in how you move. And I think there's more and more evidence, yeah, that the complexity of the environment is just as important. And there's a lot of aging research now that's really focusing on this. One of the hot arguments there is, you know, is exercising a half hour a day really the thing that helps longevity and health and healthy cognitive aging? Or is it physical activity? And most of the data now supports physical activity because it's varied, it's unpredictable. There's the engagement, you know, there's surprise and there's problem solving. It's a rich environment for the mind as opposed to just, you know, routine exercise. So sort of there's a trend now to really zoom in on what is it about the physical engagement that provides so much benefit.
Yeah, I was just reflecting on my own physical experience when I was, and this is actually probably just before I did start listening to the book, but we had a lot of rain over our winter here and I was walking the dog. And again, I, in the early stages of dog walking, first dog, never been through this before. So it's been something I've engaged in with gusto. And I went walking with my son and what looked to me like wet grass, but we're on a downhill slide. And I thought, well, that's okay. Dog takes off. I try to keep up with her. And of course, that was a lot wetter and more slippery than I anticipated. And both feet went up in the air and my son watched. And he did rush to check that I was okay before he burst out laughing as I hit the ground. And I'm wet and covered in mud and perfect. A little sore and sorry for myself. But, you know, what it did when you reflect on that kind of experience was that, you know, from then on in all my walks, I have, as soon as I've approached anything that looked like a wet slope, automatically I'm like, right, okay, we need to approach this differently. I need to take this a little slower. I need to be cautious of what might be there because it's not what I'm visually seeing necessarily.
Yeah. And there's no way to, the only way you can figure this stuff out is by doing it. Because it has to match exactly to your body, nobody else's body, yep. Your body, your shoes, all the talking in the world isn't going to matter. I go through this in the book talking about black ice, right? You know, talking about, you know, like every winter in New England, in the US, there's black ice and there's just an explosion of fractures because everybody forgets how to walk on it and they relearn every year. And there's no escaping the practice, right? That's another example of this idea of the rust, right? That your motor system's smart, but it has to tune itself up to different conditions and reacquire this kind of knowledge.
The hard way.
And there's some people are really good at it and some people never quite get it. Hopefully you'll get that.
Well, I haven't come a cropper quite in the same way since. So hopefully I don't forget over my summer and when it's another wet winter that I do it all over again. But, you know, there's every chance that I will. Scott, why is it, do you think, you know, we talk about this as being thinking without thinking. So, you know, there's this huge amount that's going on in our minds, our brains that we're unaware of that plays such a huge part in our everyday experience. Why is it, do you think, we don't understand this? You know, we talk a lot about what we think and what we feel and what's going on in our brains. And as you say, you know, there's so many things that we might try to explain that really cannot be explained. It has to be experienced. Why do we have this big gap in our thinking about who we are as human beings and how we physically operate in the world?
We don't know, but, you know, we can speculate. And there's a couple of different ideas. One that I think is favored by some engineering colleagues who think about what it takes to control complicated things is that you have to create a layered architecture. And you want to make it so that the layers can operate kind of independently of each other. They have protocols for talking to each other, but you want some firewalls there. And so a dear colleague at Caltech, John Doyle, once said, the last thing you want, Scott, is to be able to think about what you want your blood pressure to be. you don't want to go poking around in there, right? Just don't stick a stick into that thing. You're going to really break something. Same with your breathing. You know, we can have volitional control over some of these things like breathing because it's so tied in with our voice and so forth. But like blood pressure, heart rate, we don't have direct access to that, right? Sure, you can meditate or do sorts of experiential things to help your blood pressure if it's high. But it's not like I can say, well, I want it to, right now, I'm going to set it at 128 over 72, right? I mean, it's just that we're not allowed to do that.
You can't just switch it on and switch it off.
And so that's just built into the wiring. You just can't get there from here. The wiring won't allow you to do that. And so that's a good thing, right? You have a lot of stuff that just maintains the organism that you can't get to. Now you think about movement. Well, a simple thing to do is just try eating your dinner with your other hand and the amount of effort and concentration it takes. And try to have a conversation with your kid at the same time and everything else that's going on, right? You don't want that, right? The mental cost of that movement control is immense. And it really takes away from the freedom you have with your thought. So again, the idea is you create a layer. So you really minimize the amount of access you have down into the motor system. And in fact, we're really poor at thinking about movement at the level of muscles. You could sort of do that with a finger, maybe moving it up or down. But in general, that's not how we think about action with our conscious mind. We think about goals. And then we learn through experience what kind of physical requirements are needed to accomplish that goal. And we're really good at that, right? So we just kind of pass on the goal and let this other system under the hood solve it for us and get it done. And the other reason we want that hidden and sort of inaccessible or to be able to run without us thinking about it is because thinking is really slow. There's a good analogy. I don't know if you remember the old dial-up modems in the old days.
Where I do. You know, bing, old enough for that. You know, yeah.
And remember how slow they were?
Yep.
That's about how fast sort of your mental verbal mind is operating. It's pathetically slow. It's robust, right? I mean, it's massive in scope in terms of the kinds of things you can think of. But the speed at which you think is very, very slow. Now, you compare that to hitting a tennis ball that's got some spin on it or, you know, catching yourself, you know, reflexively if you're slipping on the grass or playing any kind of sport or dodging somebody or driving a car, all those things. The speed with which you need to react and respond or anticipate are orders of magnitude faster. So you want that. You want that separate, right? You want to allow that freedom to occur there. In the motor system, so it can just do it very quickly.
So it's an interesting kind of almost paradox in my mind forming now that, you know, there has to be kind of just an assumption, just has to do it on its own because we can't think fast enough to otherwise anticipate anything probably physically if we don't. And as you say, you don't really want to go tinkering around with that. So, you know, there has to be this layer of it just happens automatically. But if we're also saying that to some extent we need to have an awareness of our physical intelligence if we're going to kind of stop the rust, you know, if we're going to keep practicing and learning and actually investing a little bit of time in this system in order to keep it operating at its best within the limits that we do have control over, that is that sort of we need a level of awareness. So just completely taking it for granted isn't enough. But also acknowledge that there's only so much we can do.
I think the escape hatch for us is we set good goals, right? You create goals. You create interesting goals. You know, you can do it walking the dog. There's all sorts of physical goals you can set. And then, you know, everything else follows suit. One of the things that's interesting about this idea of layering is it gets really mixed up with the giant literature embodiment. So this is one of those words that's really slippery. And I don't talk about it too much in the book, but embodied cognition, everybody uses this word in to mean different things. And so you could sort of see what we're trying to get at here is there's a big part of physical intelligence that's about it. It's embodied intelligence, right? You know, it's how the body is smart. And that's kind of how the roboticists thought of it when they're the ones who coined the term. A guy named Rodney Brooks said, look, if I want to make a smart robot, I don't want to run everything up to this little crappy computer at the top and then run it back down to the limbs because there's all this cost of getting the information up and getting it back down. And then there's also my slow computers at the top. And if I give it too many things to do, it's all going to crash. So let's put as much intelligence out in the body as we can. And so it could just be like the arch of your foot has a spring ligament and the arch of your foot is springy. I could have made a whole robotic controller to control with muscles to control that springiness. He was like, no, I just put a, evolution said, just figured out, just put a springy tendon in there and that'll do the trick. So that's a musculoskeletal embodiment of intelligence. So you stick as much stuff out as you can. When you fly a jet plane, or in the old days when we flew Boeing jet planes, they put a lot of computers out in the wings to figure out how much forced to apply to the ailerons and flaps and things like that. They don't rely on the dashboard and the central computers. Just stick that intelligence out into the body. And so we do it in our spinal cord. We have enormous intelligence for regulating posture in our spinal cord. We have it in the brainstem, our basal ganglia, cerebellum. It's not all coming from a central little computer at the top. So that's embodied cognition. And again, when you do that, you're creating layers. So that, and you're freeing up the CPU to do, or the central stuff to do fancier or different kinds of calculation. Now, what's happened in the literature is people said, there's sort of a psychological argument that says, well, evolutionarily, anything we can know cognitively has to be something that came through the body. Our mind can only really represent things that in some sense would be things that could be experienced. Now, we can all think of counter examples. I can think about flying in a spaceship in a, you know, in another galaxy, and that's never going to happen.
The essence of imagination,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it really belittles our imaginations. So I think that's kind of an overstretch of what the original idea was. But I think the original idea is super important for physical intelligence because it really gets at your idea of you want to free up some parts of the mind by making other things inaccessible and just letting them do the thing on their own.
Mm. That awareness piece in there around what's physically happening. So again, you know, I was imagining I've done yoga for many, many years. And for me, there is an awareness of my body that I know wasn't present prior to doing that, an awareness even of things like posture, which obviously, you know, there's an awful lot of automatic stuff going on, but I do become aware that, oh, you're slouching, you know, stand up this way. I'm aware of how I move my body in a way that I wasn't previously when I'm standing up, you know, and I'm any kind of physical activity. So I suppose they're the sorts of things that we can have a consciousness about that if, and we think about that in terms of goals, you know, if I have a goal of being fitter, stronger, particularly in relation to aging, or perhaps, you know, maintaining physical capability that we might otherwise lose. And then, of course, you know, for athletes, obviously they would have goals to get better at particular physical pursuits.
Yeah.
That's, I suppose, the element then of the mind and where this fits into this.
Yeah. And our access to our posture is really interesting, right? And our sort of body awareness. And it is so learnable. I mean, yoga is probably the best example of how you can be so, you become so aware of all these postures. Certainly rock climbers, they become really aware because it's essentially like yoga. Or dance is another example. You know, you really have to understand body position in space, and it's all relative. And some of these, you do it with respect to gravity. Like yoga, you're doing everything with respect to gravity. Like that's your frame of reference to really understand how well you're doing. Other things, you don't need gravity, like gymnastics where you're twirling and whirling. It's like, it's all with respect to yourself, right? And how tucked you are and how spinny you're going. So there's all kinds of interesting things you can do. The fact that we can just learn all this so readily and arbitrarily, we say, well, I'm going to get really good at this or I'm going to get good at that. It's a really beautiful thing. It's also interesting to see these patients, right, with all these exotic disorders that really reveal how much you rely on this. And the literature right now is confusing, I think. Well, the story is just not done in terms of understanding what's the relationship between knowing my body posture and really understanding sort of like the physical knowledge you get from yoga versus your identity of what your body is, what you think you look like. They're different things.
If you ever practice in front of a mirror, exactly. You can realize.
We're all irrationally exuberant in terms of the appearance. But so there's a lot of argument that's like eating disorders are isolated to, you know, the body identity. But then they will also demonstrate, people with anorexia will demonstrate movement that reflects something very fundamentally. They're representing the size of their body and probably their posture as well in ways that are also abnormal. So these things aren't totally separable, and how they relate to each other is still kind of an open question and really, really exciting area because it's right at the heart of a lot of psychological difficulties for people. Body identity plays a huge role for people.
And obviously, as the more we can unpick and understand some of those more complex topics, that's where treatment pathways start to emerge, isn't it? You can actually, you know, we need to really understand what's going on. And I know with things that I have very, you know, it's only a passing interest as a professional in eating disorders, but what we thought was going on 20 years ago compared to what we understand now might be going on is vastly different. And as we do start to understand more of these complexities, obviously that is going to change what things look like in terms of treatment in 20 years' time and beyond.
Absolutely. You know, I've become terrible because in my clinic, essentially, as you could guess from the book title, all my patients are condemned to a life of physical activity as a cure-all for everything. Migraines, dizziness, whatever.
Go out and hike.
Get out and move. Concussions, whatever, you know. But, you know, there's doesn't work for everything. But in terms of somatic problems, people don't feel well if their emotions are tied to body feelings and those body feelings don't feel right, then physical activity is a huge benefit. Just the act of moving, it's just like from what you get from yoga, the wellness from that action is really beneficial, really powerful.
It feels counterintuitive, or I don't know if it feels, perhaps physically it doesn't feel counterintuitive. Maybe we've learned to think of it as counterintuitive because I know for me, I have all my adult life due to an injury had occasional back pain, and I know mostly through yoga and the experience of actually doing it that I need to get up and move. And as soon as I get up and move and stretch and do yoga, it resolves itself very quickly. And if I keep doing that, then I'm less likely to experience it. And yet so often I think our belief is that I've got a sore back, I better stay in bed or not move.
Yeah.
Is it because somehow we think we're going to make it worse? Is it something we've been taught over time through, you know, just historical beliefs about how to treat these things? What is going on there?
Most people don't go to medical school.
True.
And so, or any kind of allied medical training. And so their notions of how their body works is essentially folk medicine, right? It's based on all kinds of narratives because they just never learned anything else, right? So they're filling in a gap. And so it's only natural to think, well, if I move it, I might break it. It's a very common intuition people have. It doesn't feel good, so I shouldn't move it because I'll make it worse.
Makes sense, yeah.
And it's a big deal for aging, and it's a big deal for patients with all kinds of neurologic disease because there's a tipping point where it suddenly becomes almost impossible to get people to move and to get them physically active again. There's sort of this point of no return of passivity. And if you're a clinician, it's terrifying, right? It's really terrifying to see someone get to that because it's kind of like they're over the edge. I can't pull them back and get them into a physical space where I know they're going to feel better. They're forcing my hand so that they're going to become dependent on medications and other things that are not particularly effective, right? And it's really hard to get people back once they've gotten to that point. And I think that's, for therapists, I would say it's probably one of the most important things to try to figure out, like, what to do, how to keep people from getting there.
Mm. Yeah, and there's obviously a lot of parallels there. If you're describing that, you're talking about, you know, what the physical implications are, but there's an awful lot of the mind element, the beliefs, you know, the psychology in that's going to make a difference to the outcome. So, you know, my purpose here with this podcast is to kind of get these conversations out there, get information out there so that the average person does have a better repertoire of options and ways of thinking about a situation. And this is perhaps one of those examples where if we can think about our physical selves differently and what works and what doesn't work, then perhaps we are able to access a greater repertoire of options to keep us in a better physical and psychological shape.
They go hand in glove. And it doesn't take much. That's the other amazing thing. Most of the, you know, if you just look at the exercise literature and say the exercise benefits on the heart, it's basically go do something that makes you sweat for 20 minutes. It's not that much, right? Doing it for 2 hours doesn't get you much more than you'd get in the first 20 minutes. So it's not like this is costing you huge amounts of time. And the same at, you know, it's, I think, true with the cognitive benefits. It doesn't, you know, you don't have to go on a 6-day walkabout, although those are great. you know, you just get out a little bit every day, the dog walk, it has huge psychological benefits.
It's been very interesting, actually, I didn't notice it so much in the second of our lockdowns, you know, 2020 being the year that it's been. In the first, and I think that was probably partly reflective of our local weather. So second lockdown, we were into winter, which is nothing like a North American East Coast winter, but it's pretty miserable. Yeah. First time around, the weather was still reasonable. And I saw so many more people out walking, cycling. And I think it has lasted quite a bit. I think that probably if we compared, and I don't know if somebody may be doing the numbers, I'm not sure, you know, this year to last year, but certainly it was noticeable. And people of all age groups who you just did not normally see walking, you know, we've got hiking trails nearby. It was mayhem in our hiking trails because people were only allowed outside to exercise. Yep. And so they said, right, let's all get up to the local bushland and walk around a bit. So it'll be interesting to see if some of that sustains, whether people actually start to feel some of those benefits enough to maintain the motivation to keep doing it.
You just gave me an idea for how to finish this opinion piece I started, which was, I noticed the same thing in California at the first lockdown. Everybody was on the trails. It was fantastic. Just the amount of families you would never see on trails were out there. It was wonderful. Across the board, you know, and it was mayhem here as well. And then they were talking about shutting the trails down, right? Because it was just like, and oh no, we can't have people walking the streets. So I started a piece called Your Inalienable Right to Take a Walk. That is like a fundamental human right to be able to just go walk and get out. And no matter how bad the pandemic is, you know, we have to have that. But now I think that's the start. But now that we're like into an second or third wave everywhere, it's really like, let's keep up the walking. Let's not lose sight of the benefits of this, right? And that's a big one.
And there is that extra element because I know, I mean, locally we've been talking about the mental health benefits of exercise.
Yeah.
But also, you know, here we're talking about the fact that, yeah, I mean, there's a mental emotional benefit, but there's also a physical benefit, a neurological benefit continuing to move and the fact that they're all tied together. So, you know, thinking about your opinion piece, lends that extra piece of weight to that. You know, this is not just about keeping people's mood buoyant, although we know it helps with that. It's longevity, it's physical activity in terms of aging, it's all of that under the hood stuff that you talk about in the book, all of that incredible stuff that the brain is doing that we don't see or notice that we potentially lose if we can't get outdoors and move.
So ironically, the book came out right at the start of the pandemic. So there's sort of an irony of writing this book about physical intelligence when everyone's locked indoors.
No one expected it. Scott, there's one other topic, and I'm sort of hesitant because I think this could open up to another half an hour's conversation. We don't have all that much time to do that. But towards the end of the book, you talk about this notion of fatigue and perseverance and mood and choice and our beliefs about fatigue and where that's tied up in what's physical, but also what is perhaps psychological. And that it seems to have some flow-on impacts potentially for our understanding of some mental health disorders and all sorts of things. Can you tell us a bit about fatigue and perseverance and mood and choice?
Well, I really frame it in terms of physical fatigue. And so it's an open debate whether cognitive fatigue or sort of emotional fatigue should really be in the same wheelhouse or not. But at least in the physical space, we used to think of physical fatigue as sort of your muscles release some chemicals and that tells your brain, you know, you've had enough. It's like a governor, right? Slow it down because the feedback says you got to protect your muscles because they're redlining. And then I go through the history of this guy, Musso, one of the very first physiologists, wonderful experiments with frogs and dogs and people lifting weights and all kinds of rowers and all kinds of fun things from, you know, Lago di Como in Italy in 1890. And he makes the case that you could have that kind of fatigue where you release chemicals and you're just going to shut the system down so you don't break anything. But he says, more often than not, that's not what's going on. What's really happening is that's an emotion. Just as your brain creates a whole repertoire of emotions, this is just another one of those emotions you have. And it's tied to the activity you have. And what it's doing is it's anticipating, your brain's making a guess how much reserve you need. So you have to imagine now being a caveman or out in the veldt or doing it out in the outback, right? And you've got to walk 30 miles or you don't really even know how far you have to walk. You just know it's going to be a long way. You've got to hold a lot in reserve. And so fatigue was a way of cashing some resources, right? Some physical resources. You keep some money in the bank, so to speak. You don't spend yourself out prematurely. Because that's a really hard thing. We don't have access to our body sort of cognitively to know, like, how much more can I go? How much faster can I go? We don't know, unless we're an athlete and we've done it 100 times.
You can have a lot of beliefs about it.
Yeah, you can have a lot of beliefs, but by and large, we're really bad at estimating how much more get up and go we have. So it's a way of protecting you so you always have a good reserve. And evolutionarily, that's a very smart system. And so that's kind of the fatigue idea. And then all the coaches now for endurance sports know this, and they train their athletes, essentially train through that feeling. It's kind of like having a toe that hurts in a foot race. You just run through that pain. This isn't pain. It's a fatigue feeling. You can really counterweight it. And so that's kind of a neat thing. And then coupled with that is this idea of perseverance, right? That feeling of, I got to keep going, right? I got to keep going. I'm stuck in a snowstorm or my car broke down and I've got to walk down the road until I get to a town. And my kid's sick, so I got to really push it. I got to get there. It's starting to rain. I got to keep going, right? No matter what the odds, I got to keep going. So that's perseverance. And the neat thing is you can see these brain regions that now really are the drivers of perseverance. And they're closely coupled to brain regions you have that are involved in movement and action and physicality. And they're also really coupled to areas that are involved in decision-making and trying to adjudicate what's the value of what you're trying to do, and what are the costs of what you're trying to do. And then on top of that, you're also trying to guess. You're also trying to always try, the brain's always trying to predict the future. So it's trying to say, okay, if I persevere and I keep going, will this actually even work, right? I'm trying to forecast whether my choices are actually going to play out. So all these things are tied together, and they're all tied in with how hard your heart beats, what your vasculature is doing, whether your body thinks you're going to bleed to death or not. All these physical reactive things going on in your body are absolutely tied in with the sense of perseverance, the choices you're making, and whether or not you're trying to put a lid on it with fatigue. So they all kind of intertwine with each other.
Yeah, and I think that for me, coming towards the end of the book, was that starting to think about this as these multiple, complex, fascinating, interplaying systems that as we learn more about it and as we just give it some thought, you know, even the idea of using, you know, fatigue being an emotion, that it is just a, you know, something that emerges as a property of this complex system, and we feel it and we notice it and we are inclined to kind of assume that a feeling is a fact, you know, I feel this, therefore I am. But to even just to be able to think about it as, well, I'm feeling this, it's just a feeling. What do I know about it, and how that plays into then the perseverance or your willingness to persevere with whether that's something. And as you say, you know, we're talking about it physically, but maybe it's starting to reveal some stuff in terms of our psychological understanding of fatigue as well, you know, what that might teach us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. My final question for you is, what led, because you do, as I mentioned before, you know, you have this lovely narrative of your own experience climbing and hiking throughout the book, which probably indicates to me where this comes from. But what was it that has sparked this interest for you, both personally and professionally, in this particular field of physical intelligence?
Ironically enough, these were always at odds with each other. So I grew up mountaineering and climbing and being in the backcountry and really valuing wilderness and wild places and nature. And, you know, the more extreme and remote, the better. And the fewer the people, the better. Right. So you really are out there. And that was in diametric opposition to, you know, going to a medical school, being a resident, being a faculty member, living in Los Angeles, living in Atlanta, you know, absolute urban academic institutional life. Those two things are completely at odds with each other. But I guess, you know, just really being interested in how the brain pulls all this off. You know, as a neurologist, people don't come to me. Or the challenges as a neurologist were not, never started as a sort of emotional, psychological challenges. They were physical challenges. People want to move. And then one day I realized, well, that's kind of like what I like to do when I'm not an academic, right? I have this, my own love of movement. And then that's actually what I study with patients and what I study with brain imaging and in the science I do. So they kind of just came together in this book, sort of a labor of love to bring those two things together.
So do you think it was that contrast of having had that experience growing up in that physical, very physical world that did rely on that intelligence? Because as you said, it's not just the physical movement. You know, when you're in the wilderness, there is threat and fear and anticipation and space, literally and metaphorically, I suppose, metaphysically maybe, and then being able to contrast that with perhaps sitting in a consulting office.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And well, I'm actually quite serious about this statement, but in the book I say, you know, when you go into the wilderness, you don't need to be mindful. You know, you don't have to do mindfulness exercises. You just are, right? It just is. And so that makes you reflect on some of the things we now do in urban environments and whether or not they're just proxies for what are very, very natural things in the wild. That sense of it's not so much impending danger, but it is, you know, you got to be on your toes, right? You got to look around and be aware of what's going on. And that's a good thing. It's a fun exercise.
And so your top tip perhaps for our listeners who have perhaps suddenly realized that they have all of this capacity that they didn't even know they had, and now they know they have it, they want to keep it.
Well,
what should we be doing?
Well, don't go off on a 7-mile hike into a place you've never been with no map and get lost and rescued.
Don't go all or nothing on us.
Yeah, don't go all or nothing. Yeah. Everything in small portions and then work your way up. Yeah, but get out and get moving, and direct experience and complexity is good. Complexity, natural environments are really interesting. And if you've never hiked off a trail before, walk off a trail for a little bit, things like that, you'll discover all kinds of interesting things about yourself.
And I'm hoping that if 2020 has taught us anything, that, you know, people have just had so many more opportunities, or the motivation has been different to try these things. I know certainly locally, even for people in our urban environments, you know, we're very fortunate in Australia that you don't have to travel very far to get to a green space, and perhaps a, you know, more rugged than your average urban park, you know, so maybe it's just, we've had this awareness. This is something that life has given us the opportunity to appreciate. Keep doing it.
That's right. Well said.
Scott, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a fascinating conversation, and we really appreciate your time and expertise. I will put the details of the book into our show notes for today so that people know where to find it. It is an intriguing, I will admit that you do go very deep into the science in parts, and I did my very best to concentrate and try and understand.
I'm not sugarcoating it.
But it's balanced out beautifully by the narrative piece in there and some of the, you know, fascinating examples, both of the studies that have been done, but also some of the examples of patients that you've seen that, you know, and their personal experiences. So yeah. A lovely balance there. And I do encourage people to have a read or perhaps have a listen while they're walking the dog.
Thank you.
So how interesting was that? I bet you'll start to think differently about how you move and what might be going on in your brain to help you to do what you do now that you've listened to Scott. There's some great tips in there as well about how to stay physically and neurologically well. I'd like to see everyone out there hiking a little bit more, perhaps. Scott's book, which I highly recommend if you're inclined towards brain sciencey stuff, is Physical Intelligence, The Science of Thinking Without Thinking, which is published in both physical and audio versions if you'd like to listen in while walking or hiking. We've included links in the show notes for today's episode, as well as links to find out more about Scott, his research, his writing, and his work. There's also a link to review this podcast in the show notes. We have finally found a way to make leaving a podcast review easier, and I'd love it if you would do exactly that. I do read and very much appreciate every review, and it makes it so much easier for others to find and find out about the show and our wonderful guests and the wisdom and knowledge that they share when we have recent and plentiful reviews. So when you get a moment right now, if it's practical, pop over to reviewthispodcast.com/potential. You'll get a simple form that asks for a title, a brief review, and a star rating out of 5. You can then choose to share your review on Apple Podcasters or Stitcher or Podchaser, and then you're done. Quick and simple. Very much appreciated and very helpful. We'll put a link in the show notes again, but it's an easy one to remember. It's reviewthispodcast.com/potential. Thank you. Okay, so what do we have coming up in our next episode? Well, we're talking about how to avoid the number one regret of the dying. And what's that, I hear you ask? Well, it's living the life that others expect of you rather than having the courage to live a life that's true to you. My guest is Eric Winters, a self-leadership coach, speaker, and author of Swipe Right on Your Best Life, Simple Steps to a Bolder Life with Fewer Regrets, which is a lovely, entertaining, well-written, and engaging science-based guide to living your best life and being your best self. I am reading it at the moment and thoroughly enjoying it. Lots of good tips in there. So Eric will join me for episode 89 of the Potential Psychology Podcast, which will be available for your ears on the 25th of November 2020. Wow, we are almost at the end of this crazy year. So until then, thank you so much for listening. Today, it's been great being here with you. Stay safe, go well, do everything in your power to fulfill your potential, even in the smallest of ways. Please leave a review of the show, and I will be back with you in a couple of weeks.